So today I want to talk about Dogen's essay, Canon, or Avalokitesvara. Avalokitesvara is the Sanskrit name for Canon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. So in Sanskrit, he's called Avalokitesvara. In Tibetan, he's Chenrezig. In Chinese, she is Guanyin. And in Japanese, she's called Canon. So this is the Bodhisattva of compassion in their various guises. So the name Avalokitesvara means the one who regards the sound, the cries of the world. And Canon or Guanyin is two characters. The first means to regard or to observe. And the second is voice or sound. So instead of some of the Chinese versions of Sanskrit names try to capture the meaning, and some of them try to capture the sounds. So for Guanyin, they tried to capture the meaning of the name Avalokitesvara in Chinese characters. So the bodhisattvas are kind of not so easy to explain. I can start with the literal definition. Do you remember when you were taking public speaking in school, and you thought a really, really clever way to start your public talk was to say, the Oxford Dictionary defines Avalokitesvara as. So anyway, bodhisattva is two Sanskrit words. The bodhi means awaken or enlightenment, and sattva means a living being. And actually the Chinese pusa is a transliteration, so it's trying to capture the sound bodhisattva instead of, you know, the meaning of, you know, enlightenment being. The Buddha also is derived from bodhi, which means awakening or enlightenment. And the idea of bodhisattvas, it's not really from the early scriptures. In the early Buddhist teaching, the enlightened Buddha was understood to have, after his death, to have gone completely beyond, like we say in the Heart Sutra. So much so that the earliest Buddhist art will show, you know, various monks and other characters, but not the Buddha himself. So instead, they'll have something like, you know, a pair of footprints or an empty chair, which represents the Buddha, because the Buddha has gone beyond. And then in later Mahayana teachings, especially the Lotus Sutra, the narrative changes a bit. So in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha reassures his disciples, of course, I haven't really gone. You are my children. I love you. I would never abandon you when you still need me. Although I no longer have a physical form that you can see and touch, I'm still with you, and I will be with you until you are all free from suffering and delusion. And then Mahayana Buddhism began to describe this whole pantheon of Buddhas. There's a Buddha for every occasion. And at the same time, the point of practice becomes a little bit different. So the idea is complete awakening, Bodhi. When somebody asked the Buddha, they noticed he wasn't a regular person. He had some sort of presence. And they said, what are you? Are you a man? Are you a spirit? And he said, I'm awake. And that is where the title Buddha comes from. So to wake up, to completely see through our delusions was the goal of practice in the early sutras. And in the Mahayana tradition, it started to change a little bit, that there is a new kind of awakening, the Bodhisattva path of awakening, which Shantideva describes in A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. He says, with a wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment. Enthused by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind for full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space endures, as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So the Bodhisattva ideal is to have the wisdom and clear seeing of a fully realized Buddha. And because of great compassion for living beings, to still return again and again to this blend-stayed world to help and to teach. So with the wish to free all beings, I shall always go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I reach full enlightenment. Enthused by wisdom and compassion, today in the Buddha's presence, I generate the mind for full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. As long as space endures, as long as sentient beings remain, until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So at this point in their description of what a bodhisattva is, some teachers will go on to say that the practice of non-Mahayana Buddhists is a selfish practice because they don't aspire to be bodhisattvas. And I don't think that's really fair or true. So there are schools of Buddhism that don't recognize the Lotus Sutra, which, you know, they have some reason to not recognize the Lotus Sutra because it wasn't composed until more than 600 years after the lifetime of Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. For that reason, they have a different perspective on enlightenment, and they have sutras that back up their understanding of enlightenment. And they listen to Shantideva's verse and they say, yeah, that is a really nice sentiment, but enlightenment doesn't work that way. You can't get a return ticket to Nirvana. It's one way only. So, yeah, again, it's not that they're practicing only for themselves and they don't care about other beings. It's because they have a different definition of the terms. Since Zen is a school of Mahayana Buddhism, you know, we do aspire to the Bodhisattva ideal. Independent of the historical accuracy of the Lotus Sutra. In fact, after this Dharma talk, we will all commit to the four great vows of a Bodhisattva. So that's a Bodhisattva, a being who is awake and who dedicates her life to awakening others. And then Avalokiteshvara is the specific bodhisattva. So like I mentioned, there's a bodhisattva and a Buddha for every occasion, but some of them are a little bit better known than others. And Avalokiteshvara is probably the most famous bodhisattva. So as I said before, all bodhisattvas are motivated by great compassion for living beings who continue to suffer. And Avalokiteshvara is kind of more than just motivated by compassion. She has really done a deep dive into compassion. She's an expert who specializes in compassion. By the way, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara in Indian and Tibetan iconography is usually portrayed as male, and in Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Vietnamese iconography is usually portrayed as female. So I usually refer to Avalokiteshvara as she because that's the version I'm most familiar with, but you can call her a woman or man or non-binary. She is happy to show up in whatever form is most helpful. And again, this is a little bit confusing because, you know, some texts and ceremonies, including our monthly well-being ceremony, they speak of Guanyin Kanon as a kind of entity that we can petition, that listens to our prayers and can do things in our lives in the physical world. And at the same time, she's seen as, you know, this the embodiment of compassion. So kind of like an avatar of the compassionate mind of all Buddhas. If it were to take form, it would take the form of Avalokiteshvara. And you know, I don't know if it's really as confusing as it seems. I remember I was at some conference and someone was relaying a story of one of their teachers who was an excellent surgeon and who taught surgery in Nigeria, I believe, an African country. I think it was Nigeria. And he was presenting something at this medical school in Nigeria, and he mentioned offhand, you know, one of the challenges in treating Nigerian patients is that they tend to somaticize their symptoms. So if somebody who is grieving might say, I have a pain in my chest, because that is how they feel grief. And they might not need an EKG because it's not actually the heart organ. It's this is how grief is expressed in their body. And then after he spoke, one of his students at this medical school spoke, and she said, we should be careful in teaching in treating Westerners, because they tend to psychologize their symptoms. So maybe it makes more sense to view Avalokiteshvara as a goddess existing somewhere listening to prayers. Maybe that makes more sense than to envision her as, you know, this feeling of compassion that exists in the universe and the hearts and minds of all beings. but she can be either one. He can be either one or both or neither. And part of the reason I wanted to discuss the essay canon today is that right after the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, my teacher, Norman Fisher, wrote an essay about Avalokiteshvara, about canon in times of trouble. And I'd like to share that with you. In the Sharangama Sutra, we hear of Guanyin, the bodhisattva who, through the power of her practice of listening, is able to hear deeply the cries of the world. She hears these cries with a still and perfect serenity, and she understands that they are all manifestations of the perfect light of enlightenment. Because of this, she remains peaceful and is able to offer exactly the right kind of help to beings according to their situation. I suppose we all are and aspire to be Guanyin. But also, we aren't Guanyin. We are human beings. And so when we confront the stark realities of the delusion of human violence, we cringe. We aren't serene. We get jittery and angry. We feel grief and anguish, terror and disorientation. I don't think we want not to feel these things. If we are human, we feel them and we want to feel them. Maybe we have to be both. Both Guanyin, who accepts what is with perfect and effective equanimity, and also poor human beings who find what happens sometimes unbearable and unacceptable. And yet, we have to bear it and accept it because there isn't any alternative. Meditation practice itself, the simple practice of being quiet, the practice of listening to ourselves, to the cries of the world, listening deeply with an accurate ear, allowing an opening to what we hear. That practice is more relevant in times like these than ever. There are, in a crisis, a million ways to help, and we all should help in whatever way we can. But beyond help, and in addition to it, we need to bear witness to what is happening, to take it in, imagine it, feel it, grieve over it, accept it, not accept it, understand it, fail to understand it, and comfort each other in that. To do that, we need to sit. We need the expansiveness of our sitting, as well as our chanting and our prayers. It seems absolutely essential. There are, in a crisis, a million ways to help, and we should all help in whatever way we can. But beyond help, and in addition to it, we need to bear witness to what is happening. Maybe we have to be both Guanyin, who accepts what is with perfect and effective equanimity, and also poor human beings who find what happens sometimes unbearable and unacceptable. And yet we have to bear it and accept it because there isn't any alternative. To do that, we need to sit. We need the expansiveness of our sitting as well as our chanting and our prayers. It seems absolutely essential. Shunryu Suzuki once said that the point of Zen is to see things as they really are and help them to be their best. There's a very popular image of Guanyin, which shows her with 1,000 eyes and 1,000 hands. So she has this ability to accurately perceive what is happening, to see things as they really are. And then these hands that reach out and offer assistance in accordance with what she sees with her Buddha eye, to help things be their best, to see things as they really are and to help them be their best. Of course, for we poor human beings, neither part of that is so easy. It's hard to see things as they are, and it's hard to know the appropriate way to help. So in his book, Keep Me in Your Heart a While, Dosho Port says, quoting Katagiri Roshi, his teacher, Katagiri Roshi said, "In the world of the Buddha, we have to do something. We live in this world with the body, and there must also be spirit. Spirit is heart, the source of existence. Manifest your spirit, which is equal to the universe. The practice you do in Zazen is exactly Buddha's practice, manifesting Buddha's world. At that time, the practice is something you do, and it is spirit, the total manifestation of the universe." Dosho Port continues, "Flailing along with one chopstick in the rice won't help you at all. Just any kind of doing won't do. In order for a doing to be in accord with universal life, the spirit must be dynamically alive and equal to the universe. Here, spirit is the identity of our hearts with the perfectly tranquil and ungraspable source of existence. We are nothing but this. At such a time, the central issue in spiritual life shifts from getting an understanding to action. How can we do it? How can we do it? When we hear the cries of the world, can we respond? Knowing all the times I've tried to respond and just made it worse, how can I do it?" This question, how can I do it, is the central question of Dogen's essay, Kenon. I'm finally getting to Dogen's essay, Kenon. So in that, he discusses a koan that asks this question, how can I do it? And it's a very popular koan with Zen teachers. So I'm going to share three perspectives on it. The first one, this is a very short description of the koan by Norman Fisher. Norman says, "This koan comes from a story about Daowu, an old Chinese Zen teacher. Daowu was the Dharma brother of Yunyan, who was Dongshan's teacher. Dongshan is one of the founding teachers of the Soto Zen lineage. This story is a dialogue between Daowu and Yunyan. Yunyan asks, 'Why does the Bodhisattva Guanyin have so many hands and eyes?' Daowu said, 'It's like reaching back for your pillow in the dark.' Yunyan says, 'I understand.' And Wu asks him, 'What do you understand?' Yunyan says, 'The whole body is covered with hands and eyes.' Daowu says, 'Almost.' Yan says, 'Then what do you say?' Wu replies, 'There is nothing but hands and eyes.'" Norman Short commentary, he says, which means all of reality is love, love that accepts suffering. To say that love or compassion is something extra, something particular, something, some admirable feeling or impulse is good, but it misses this crucial point about life. All of reality is love, love that accepts suffering. To say that love or compassion is something extra, some admirable feeling or impulse is good, but it misses this crucial point about life. Shohaku Okumura also talks about this koan in Living by Vow. He says, there is a koan that illustrates the relationship between independence and interdependence. It is a question and answer between Yunyuan Daoshan and Daowu Yuanzi. The brothers Yunyuan and Daowu were disciples of Yaoshan Weiyan, who was one of Shudo's disciples. Yunyuan was the younger brother and became a monk at an early age. Daowu worked as a government official for many years, and he became a monk 20 years later. Daowu attained the way quickly, while Yunyuan was never enlightened. Yunyuan's main disciple was Dongshan, the founder of the Soto school in China. The relationship between the two brothers, blood brothers as well as Dharma brothers, was very interesting. Yunyuan asked Daowu, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use his many hands and eyes? The Bodhisattva of great compassion is Avalokiteshvara or Kanzeon Bosatsu. He is a symbol of the Buddha's compassion. Some statues of Avalokiteshvara have 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes, one eye on each hand. Eyes are a symbol of wisdom. So this Bodhisattva has many eyes to see the differences between between beings and many hands to save them. Yunyuan's question is, how does Avalokiteshvara use so many hands and eyes? Daowu replied, it's like a man reaching behind himself in the night, searching for a pillow. Sometimes in the night, we lose our pillow and we have to find it in the darkness. Before electricity, the night was really dark. Somehow we can find the pillow, even though we cannot see it with our eyes. In a way, our whole body is our eyes. Yunyuan said, I understand. What do you understand? Daowu asked. Yunyuan answered, there are 1,000 eyes all over the body. Daowu said, that's very good, but you express only 80 or 90% of it. He was saying that Yunyuan's understanding was not yet perfect. This is a very important point in our lineage. If you really become perfect, there is nothing more to do. Our understanding should always be 80 or 90% so that we need to keep inquiring. I love that. Our understanding should always be 80 or 90% so we are always motivated to keep asking questions. Yunyuan said, that is my answer. What do you say, elder brother? Daowu replied, the whole body is hands and eyes. I said before that one of the points of this koan is whether Yunyuan and Daowu's expressions are really the same or not. Yunyuan said there are 1,000 eyes all over the body, and Daowu said the whole body is hands and eyes. In the original Chinese, only two characters are different, hen and tsu. And they both mean whole or entire. But hen means that there are hands and eyes all over the body. And in Daowu's expression, tsu means the whole body functions as eyes and hands. It's a subtle difference, but Daowu's statement is much more dynamic. Daowu is saying that our practice, not just our zazen, but our whole life, should be lived like Avalokitesvara. We have only two hands and eyes, and yet when we do something, our whole body should become eyes. When we see something, for instance, a painting, our whole body should become our eyes. We appreciate the painting with our whole body and mind. When we eat, we taste not only with our tongue, but with our whole body. The taste of food depends very much on the situation. When we do something, we do it with our whole body. The eye is the eye. It really is independent. Yet when we actually do something, we do it with our whole body and mind. All individual sense organs and parts of our body work together as one body and mind, one person. This is a very practical meaning of emptiness. Everything works together to create each situation. It is our practice to awaken to this entire reality, which includes the self and all beings, creating reality together. And just in case you're not sick of this koan yet, I have another version from John Tarrant in his book, Bring Me the Rhinoceros. I really love Bring Me the Rhinoceros. It's my favorite book on koan practice. So John Tarrant says, Yunyuan asked Daowu, how does the Bodhisattva of Great Mercy use all of those hands and eyes? Daowu said, it's like reaching behind you for a pillow in the night. Yunyuan said, I understand. Really? What do you understand? There are hands and eyes all over the body. Daowu said, that's nicely put, but it's not the whole picture. Yunyuan said, how would you put it? Daowu said, all through the body are hands and eyes. And his commentary starts, when all the stories about how to live fall away, what is left might be the real. But what about the human experience of the real? What to call it? What accurately describes it? What if the word might be love? When there was simple seeing, that would be love. Catching a ball would be love, and picking up a child also. This would make love more basic than other experiences, placing it underneath everything else, at work in the blind night and the black earth. It would touch you and everyone you know at every moment. If this were true, it might make sense of the great intimacy and contentment you can feel, just breathing and walking under the trees, walking through a spring morning, through the whole body, as the koan says. Sometimes, out of the corner of your eye, you might catch a little piece of the universe at work secretly. For example, in Game 5 of the 2002 World Series, the Giants' first baseman, JT Snow, rounded third, and as he came home, the bat boy, the 3.5-year-old son of the Giants manager, ran excitedly onto the field to grab the hitter's bat. Snow hardly broke stride. He scooped up the kid by the back of his collar and carried him home. It was elegant and automatic and made it seem a fine, warm thing that the boy had wandered onto the field, finer than if he hadn't. There were all sorts of considerations. Another runner was bearing down on home plate and the ball might have hit the boy. Yet none of this seemed to go through the runner's mind. He just incorporated the boy into the play. That is also part of compassion's action in the night. You can't be sure that what is happening is a mistake. You might find an unsuspected kindness in odd corners of an event or in yourself. If you are busy thinking that you should be kind, you might miss the reality that kindness is already present in you. That is part of compassion's action in the night. You can't be sure that what is happening is a mistake. You might find an unsuspected kindness in odd corners of event or in yourself. If you are busy thinking that you should be kind, you might miss the reality that kindness is already present in you. Another way this koan appears is when the world reaches out for you when you have not asked it to do so. There's an old story about being touched in this way, a story from China 1200 years ago. Ling Yun was wandering in the mountains and he became lost. He rounded a bend and saw peach blossoms on the other side of the valley. This sight awakened him and he wrote this poem. For 30 years, I have searched for a master swordsman. How many times did the leaves fall and the branches break into bud? But from the moment I saw the peach blossoms, I've had no doubts. There is always the chance that the world might reach out its hand, no matter how late the hour. Even if you have no strength yourself, working with this koan could mean resting in what is true. Then it is up to the koan to do the work, to show you what it was made to do and why it was sent down over the long years to lodge in your heart. The world can reach out to you without plan. If you have ever sat quietly listening to the sound of the rain, you might have had the experience that after a while, you can't tell what is rain and what is you. There is no flaw in the world. At such times, no matter how solitary you might be, it seems impossible to be lonely because you are there. And the owl, the black eucalyptus trees, the stars and the flashes of light from automobiles, it is as if they are inside your chest also, throughout the whole body of the universe, hands and eyes. I don't know about you, but I get chills reading that. I hope you enjoy it as well. Sometimes I think these Dharma talks are just me entertaining myself and you putting up with me. I have a personal relationship with this koan as well. You know, I had an encounter, you know, almost 20 years ago, when I was at my absolute lowest point. It was a really, really terrible time. My then fiance walked out on me when I was pregnant. And then after I had my baby, she picked up an infection in the hospital. And she died from it in less than a week of life. And I picked up the same infection, which ended up being very resistant to antibiotics. So I kept taking stronger and stronger medications and I just kept getting weaker and sicker. And nothing helped. And then I was admitted to hospital. And I remember one of the nurses telling my family that they could ignore visiting hours. I knew that I was dying, but, you know, I'd been through so much already and I was so tired that the thought didn't really mean that much to me. I don't remember feeling anything besides a kind of annoyed resignation. You know, kind of like that feeling when you've had a really crap day at work and then in the parking lot, your car won't start. And it's like, well, of course my car won't start. I mean, that's just what has to happen today. Because I thought nothing else could go wrong, and I knew that something else was going to go wrong. So I kind of remember feeling that way about my own death. Up until I was in the hallway outside the operating room waiting for my turn for emergency surgery. And then suddenly this detachment and numbness broke and I started crying. And a nurse ran over to me and said, "What's wrong?" And the only thing I could say was, "I'm scared." And he reached out and he said, "Hold my hand." And I held his hand and he said, "I'll stay here with you until you go to sleep. And I'll be here when you wake up." And that was it. He held my hand until the anesthesiologist put me under. And that was our only interaction. No, we didn't exchange names or really say very much. It was just a hand reaching out in the dark for me to take hold of when I couldn't do anything else. And I think that's the answer to what can we do. We can just reach out in the dark. And we can grasp the hand that reaches out to us. Even if we're not enlightened, even if we're still stumbling and confused, there is still this love that runs through all existence and is the basis for all existence. I want to end with a poem. This is called Jesus Incognito by Alison Luterman. She says, "Don't tell anyone, but I love Jesus. I love his big, dark Jewish eyes, so full of suffering and soul, like an unemployed poet, and his thick, sensuous Jewish lips, and his kinky, curly hair, just like mine, uncontrollable despite conditioner. And the way he always argues with everyone and will go to hell for love. He's just like that Buddhist god, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, except his name is easier to pronounce. When you're in trouble, it's hard to remember to yell for Avalokiteshvara, but, oh, Jesus, arises naturally every time a crazy driver hot dogs pass me on the freeway. I know I should say the Shema when I'm about to die, but will I be able to remember Hebrew at a time like that? I don't want to die saying, oh shit. I'd like to leave my body consciously, like a Tibetan Lama sitting in full lotus, with my head turned towards where I'll reincarnate next. But let's be realistic. I probably couldn't meditate enough to become enlightened in the however many years I have left. Jesus seems easier. All you have to do is love everyone." Well, seems is the key word here. Sometimes the more you try to love people, the more you hate them. Maybe it would be better to try not to love people and then watch the love force its way out of you, like grass through cement. Anything is better than organized religion. I don't like the singing in churches, all those hymns in major keys. I don't think religion should sound triumphant. It should be humble and aware of the basic incurable pathos of the human condition. And in a minor key, and sung in some mysterious ancient language like Sanskrit or Hebrew. Is it okay for me to love Jesus but not be Christian? I could try to open my heart and give away all my possessions. It's not that different from being Buddhist, after all, except for a history of witch burnings, the Inquisition, the subjugation, rape, and pillage of indigenous peoples all over the world, not to mention 20 centuries of vicious anti-Semitism. That's a lot to overlook. To get back to a baby born among animals, to a Jewish mother, Miriam. And what about that other Mary, the sexy one? Jesus, I don't believe you died a virgin. I think you needed to taste everything human to inhabit the whole mess. Blood, shit, flies, regret, envy, and why me? I owe you and all the other bodhisattvas and sages and newborn babies a debt of thanks for agreeing to come back and marry yourselves to our painful predicament again and again. And I do thank you, bowing to the infinite directions. Thank you very much. We'll